They call us the irregulars, but baby, we're always on time. Baker Street babes always leave the rest of them behind. So in Scotland Yard they send you home, you feel like you're losing your mind. If this quotidian world has got you crying, won't you two to one be mine?
And welcome to the Baker Street Babes podcast, the villain special.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun. All the bad guys in Sherlock Holmes. They're really bad. They're smarmy. They're evil. They're douchebags. It's going to be awesome.
brilliant.
Mwahaha. So, Cathars is sleeping in China, I'm assuming, because she's not here. And Taylor forgot what day of the week it was. So it's the three of us.
Huzzah!
Huzzah. There's Artie, Jen, and Christina. Curly, what the fuck you want to call me, I don't care. So I guess first, like, major shout out to all of our new followers. We are over 500 followers on Twitter now.
Ah! Awesome!
And I haven't done the new tally since the DragonCon thing came up, but we have over 4,300 listens, which is kind of awesome.
And really kind of scary. People are actually listening to what we're saying.
I know, right?
It's just really overwhelming because, you know, we started this and Curly had this insane idea and we were like, well, okay, we'll do a little podcast and see how it catches on. And yeah, it's really popular and I'm still kind of sitting here going, how did this happen?
All because of a Twitter list that Curly had.
It was just my Sherlock friends, and you just all happened to be sexy, sexy bitches, and, you know. And it's like, Baker Street Babes, that sounds like something, and then voila, it's magic.
So thank you all who listen to us and say awesome things on Twitter and questions and remarks and, yeah.
And all the awesome reactions on Tumblr. started following people. It was, like, hysterical. I loved it. It was awesome. I'm just, like, going through, because, like, there's a lot of people who follow us on Tumblr. I'm like, you know what? You should probably follow people, because why not? And then, like, you get, like, all the awesome, like, flailing and fainting gifs, and, like, what's going on? I'm just like, really? Like, I was, like, literally, like, giggling to myself in my chair. And to all the cool people at DragonCon who went up to Taylor and said hi, and like, oh my god, Cathars is actually on! She is!
Hooray!
Oh my god!
Have a Cathars.
We have a Cathars.
Yeah, if you're new to this podcast, know Curly and Cathars have this beautiful, romantic affair. Nose kisses and everything.
Yes.
I can hear you.
Yay!
Yay!
Sorry, I've just gotten out of bed, so.
Are you, like, alive? Do you hate us for making you get up this early?
Never mind.
It's okay. You missed my awesome introduction.
Oh, well.
Aw, Cathars get tea. I'm, like, stroking the screen to make you feel, like, not as miserable. Okay. So, yeah, Cathars is here now. So there's four of us. Ah!
Yeah, ni hao. I'm calling all the way from China. It's 6 in the morning. They made me get out of bed for this. So I hope you all appreciate that.
I don't, sorry.
No sympathy on that front.
Nope, very little.
Well, it goes with the theme of today's episode, which is villains. So we're being evil and nasty and making you get out of bed at 6 in the morning on Saturday morning in China. So we had quite a few people, like, tweet us, like, their favorite villains and stuff. So we'll go into that, because I think it's important to capitalize on the fact that there are more villains than just Moriarty. He usually gets the limelight because he's, like, the arch nemesis, and that's all very dramatic. But there's other ones who I think are probably worse than Mr. Moriarty. You agree?
My personal favorite story is Charles Augustus Milverton.
Which numerous people have said Charles Augustus Middleton. I have to say his name in a funny way.
More dramatic.
Let's see who says this. Mazarin221B said Charles Augustus Middleton, as well as Roylott from The Speckled Band and Russ Castle from Copper Beaches. Carrie Chandler says Charles Augustus Middleton, best villain, worst man in London. And Brewster North also said Charles Augustus Middleton, the ultimate slime ball. So there you go. He's a popular guy.
Yeah, no, he is, isn't he? I have a little bit of information about him, actually, courtesy of Wikipedia.
Wikipedia?
Go ahead.
Because we know that everything on Wikipedia is very accurate.
Correct, yes.
But I've just had a look up, and apparently Arthur Conan Doyle actually based Charles Augustus Middleton on a real blackmailer, whose name, incidentally enough, was Charles Augustus Howell. So he obviously did a lot to hide the fact that he was basing it on a real person.
That's not very creative, Arthur.
But he was apparently an art dealer, and he preyed on quite a lot of unknown people, including some of the Pre-Raphaelites. Yeah, so I don't think, yeah, he, it's quite interesting that he placed it on a real person, so it kind of makes me wonder how much the Charles Augustus Middleton, the story he describes, actually looks like this man, because I think a lot of us kind of imagine him to be a man in a big duffel coat with a kind of maybe like a greasy mustache and a kind of, you know, like quite portly gentleman, because he obviously leads quite a nice lifestyle because he steals money off a lot of people. And he describes him as the king of the blackmailers and the worst man in London. Like, Sherlock Holmes's reaction to him is really, really extreme, and like Watson is very surprised by this. I think it's probably because Holmes is annoyed that he hasn't managed to beat him yet. So he has this really extreme reaction to him, especially when he comes to the house, and obviously I can't remember, he pulls a gun on them, or yeah, Watson attempts to pull a gun on him, but he's obviously already there, and that really annoys Sherlock Holmes. So he's one of those kind of dastardly villains that always gets the better of him. And in the end, he doesn't even defeat him. Because those of us who've read the story knows what happens. Should we tell?
I think it's okay if we tell. It is quite old. So spoilers.
Yes. Apologies if you've not read the story, but at the end of it, they decide to break into Charles Augustus Middleton's house in what I assume is meant to be a bit of a piss take of Raffles. I will not be convinced otherwise. and in silk, you know, what do you call it, masks. That's definitely like taking a piss. And they hide behind a curtain, and in comes a mysterious woman who shoots him, which is quite interesting because we never find out who she is. And at the end of it, they go and find her portrait, but it's never set, like never suggested. You know, she's somebody well known, but like they never name her. So again, yeah, it's another Sherlock.
So obviously one of his victims.
Yes. Yeah. So she comes to, but I think it's suggested that she's already fallen victim to him because he went through with his threat of blackmail, so he kind of ruined her, so she had nothing to lose. Good girl.
Yeah. It's also perhaps interesting at this point to say something about blackmail in general in the Victorian age.
Indeed.
Apparently it was quite a common crime, and that's because, you know, in this day and age, we imagine that people were blackmailed for love letters, because that is quite often the way it is portrayed. But it didn't necessarily even have to be like a long and florid letter, you know, with incriminating stuff in it. Something as innocent as a note with a date and time and a place could be enough to blackmail someone. That's how serious it was, and that's how much of a problem it was. So you have to kind of put it into perspective and cast yourself back and look at it in terms of Victorian morals.
Mm-hmm.
In the Granada adaptation, they actually went so far as to suggest that one of the people that Charles Augustus Middleton blackmailed, an army officer, had a homosexual relationship with a cross-dresser.
Mm-hmm.
That's very scandalous.
Yeah, but in the actual canon, it's just said that there was a scandal, and it's never said what the scandal actually was. And I think to update it to a modern audience, to make it really visible and something that would be shocking to, well, not shocking perhaps, but, you know, that would make an impact on a 1980s audience. So that's the kind of stuff that we're dealing with here. And blackmail is a crime that is figured so often in Victorian literature, and that's because it was a common crime, and that a person could be incriminated for very, very little in today's terms.
Do you know, I was just thinking, because blackmail is, it's basically all about information. It doesn't matter what that information is. It's somebody has information that you don't want to have released. And you usually just, it's a money issue, and that's why it's such an easy crime that anybody can do it, and you don't necessarily need to be villainous in order to do it. You could be desperate.
Yeah, for sure.
True. I suppose if you needed, a lot of people obviously were in debt for whatever reason, because obviously the upper classes didn't work, and if they gambled, they were in a bit of trouble. I think that's probably one of the reasons a lot of people blackmailed. A really example, actually, if you're looking for literature where blackmailing is like kind of the core of the plot, is actually Oscar Wilde's play An Ideal Husband.
Yes.
Features around a lot of blackmail, and obviously in the end he rejects. He takes the risk and says, like, I don't care, like, what you have to say. I don't want to be under your control anymore. A bit of a risk that he takes. I've just continued reading this thing on Wikipedia about the real Charles Augustus Howell. And apparently he also came to a rather sticky end, like our own Charles Augustus Milverton, perhaps a little bit more dramatic, as he was found in a Chelsea public house with his throat slit and a 10-shilling coin in his mouth. So,
interesting.
Wow.
Was obviously that's a little bit more gruesome than what we see in the story, but obviously someone.
Well, I don't know. He does get shot.
He does get shot. Obviously, Doyle was like, "Ah, yes, I'll use that." Check out the Wikipedia page if you want to know more.
Yes, Wikipedia.
Mm-hmm.
So it's Charles Augustus Milverton. Now, here's a question: would you say he is a worse villain than Moriarty, or is Moriarty worse?
I think in terms of, like, because, so his crimes are so numerous, and, like, there's almost nothing that Holmes can do about it, like, apart from incriminating him for maybe one or two, which, you know, is, like, would not get him the kind of prison time that he thinks he deserves. I think in just sheer terms of how much he annoys Holmes, he's probably quite a bad villain. and he, you know, he kind of morally objects to what it is that he does. But I don't know, really, because Moriarty is more like a gentleman, like in the way he conducts his crimes. So I don't know, maybe Holmes thinks that Charles Augustus Milverton's worse.
Yeah, I'd actually have to agree with that. You know, and I think you hit the nail on the head. Moriarty is a gentleman. I mean, of the definition of the age. I mean, he's, you know, he's doing this stuff. It's very calculated and educated in the decisions that he's making, that it's almost like Charles Augustus is just, he's just out to make people miserable, to take advantage of people, whereas, you know, Moriarty almost feels like he's got a plan. He's got a dastardly plan, and he's going to execute it to the fullest, but he knows who his target is. And I feel like Charles Augustus kind of...
Should we think of a nickname for Charles Augustus? Because that's going to be...
We just call him Charlie.
Call him Charlie.
Good old Charlie.
Charlie boy. I'm sorry, continue.
No, I mean, that was my thing. I think Charlie, you know, God, that's just silly.
Just call him Milverton. I always call him
Milvy.
Yeah. Milvy. Oh, yeah, even better. But I feel like he doesn't necessarily, he finds an opportunity and goes with it, where I feel like if Moriarty finds an opportunity, he calculates it.
Yeah.
Which
I was going to say, he kind of nurtures it into, you know, its fullest potential, whereas, yeah, Milverton is more like a snake, you know, he kind of darts in there and is like, ah, yes, I'll use this. And I think it's the kind of the dubious moral ground that really, like, sets Holmes' teeth on edge.
Yeah, I think that's it. I mean, there are truly evil people in canon, but I think Milverton is definitely one of them, because there's just, he's completely amoral. Like, he has no moral compunctions whatsoever. He blackmails all these people, and if he doesn't get the money that he wants, which is an expense for one of Holmes' clients that can, you know, potentially ruin her, he's gonna ruin her life anyway. So, I mean, you look at that and you think that's just pure evil. Seriously.
Mm-hmm. He's out for himself and only himself, and he'll pretty much screw over anyone that he can in order to get what
he'll wants. Walk over dead bodies anytime. Like, people have committed suicide because of his blackmail.
And he doesn't care. Look at him, he doesn't care.
The fucks I do not give.
Yes. also, I think what's really interesting about this particular story, just to kind of round it off, is that he's so dastardly that it causes Holmes and Watson to kind of become criminals themselves.
Yeah.
they break into his house. Which I think is kind of, I don't know, it's a bit of Arthur Conan Doyle's sense of humour, especially the bit at the end where Lestrade, where Holmes completely trolls Lestrade. there's someone with a mustache there. And he was like, well, it could be Watson. And you can just imagine Watson there stamping on his foot under the table being like, shut up, Holmes, shut up. What are you doing? I think it's quite a funny story as well as a kind of dastardly villain.
Wait, is that all for Milvey then?
I'm sure he'll crop up again later.
Yeah, for sure. Good old Milvey. I guess maybe we'll go back to Mazarin 221B, who said Roylott from the Speckled Band as a villain.
I just think he's a bastard.
Special sort of.
He's a wanker.
His daughters want to marry off, and he's going to have to pay for that, and he doesn't want to pay for it, so he kills them, or attempts to kill them.
Yeah. It's a very loving family that they have.
There are actually a lot of creepy father figures in the canon, and a lot of screwed families, if you look at it.
Yeah, one that the stepfather, courting his stepdaughter.
Yeah, WTF.
That's my reaction to that. It's ingenious, but also just fucking creepy.
Yeah,
things people will do for money.
Yeah, and also the way that Roylott is set up and described, he has dangerous exotic animals walking around this huge manor house that he has.
Mm-hmm. I like the baboon, personally.
Yeah, baboon I can deal with, but a cheetah in the garden.
A baboon is one thing, but a freaking cheetah.
I'm actually okay with the cheetah. It's the big fucking snake I've got a problem with. I don't care if you keep that thing locked up.
Yeah, the cheetah thing reminds me that, you guys aren't going to get it, because it's Jen made. There's the Neil Patrick Harris commercial where he has a pet cheetah. Have you seen this? No.
Okay. I don't think so.
Okay, never mind.
I feel like I'm letting you down.
There will be someone listening to this who's like, I get it.
Thank you, person.
Make yourself known.
Yeah. Okay. We want to know who you are.
Continue with the snake. Do you not like snakes, Jen?
Yeah. All those scenes in Indiana Jones? Yeah, that's me.
There's a snake in the plane, Jack.
Snake in my boot.
The speckled band is just interesting.
Yeah, a lot of the stories, especially involving women, seem to be surrounding kind of villains who are after money. A lot of the cases that he solves, when Arthur Conan Doyle's being a bit lazy about, murder and other things, it seems to be a lot to do with, people wanting money and getting money off of people in elaborate ways. That seems to be a kind of a major concern, especially daughters. They're going to be expensive in Victorian time.
I love the adventure of the solitary cyclist for that. Girl has no idea she's even going to get all this money.
Yeah.
And they're trying to marry her off. I love that. They're so evil. It's clever.
Yeah, that story is so strange because it's only about maybe 3/4 of the way through you actually realize what's going on. And I think Holmes has kind of worked out already probably. But you're just like, what is going on? Why are people following her on a bicycle? This is really weird. But they're pretty evil actually. At the end, I think somebody gets shot or something. But it's one of those moments where Holmes steps forwards and does his great deduction, and he's talking and talking and talking and what's stood there watching him kind of with heart in his eyes, wow. And when he stops talking, he's kind of bereft.
Yeah, from his... The bit that always gets me about that story is when he asks them how they divided up, which of them would court her and who would, play which part. And they just say, yeah, we played cards for it. They even treat her like a person. Yeah. They just treated her like some kind of, you know, thing, some kind of property. You guys are just so evil, it's not even funny.
I mean, come on, she's a woman. I mean, whatever.
Yeah!
That too, and also there's a man of the cloth who's involved in all of this. I mean, granted, he was excommunicated, but dude, I was just like, really? You're gonna do, what is wrong with you? You're going to hell, you realize this, right?
I think it's one of those tropes in Victorian literature that you have to have like an evil preacher somewhere kind of crops up in the story. a corrupt man of God, because people are like, oh my God, why would he do that? And it's kind of shocking.
Who else did she... Madeline gave us like three of them. Thank you. Russ Castle from Copper Beaches.
Blue Castle, sorry.
Sire. I'm American.
Thank you for giving us all a bad name.
I would just like to say that Christina is, oh, Curly is not representative of all Americans everywhere. Just a small amount of them.
Thank you so much for that.
I'm sorry, Roos Castle. Continue. Go on, Audie, talk about Roos Castle.
Roos Castle, there is no S in his name.
Well, they spelled it with an S. This is not my fault.
The typo, because before I sat down to make this podcast, I went through my lovely edition of the canon and took down some names. So I could have just gone through our Twitter feed, you know, but anyway.
You know what? Suck it.
Mr. Rickhouse in Copper Beaches. Because what happens in that story is this young girl gets hired as... Well, she's looking for work as a governess, and she gets hired by this strange person who asks her to do a lot of strange things, like, you know, wear a specific dress and cut her hair short and everything. And turns out that he's doing this to get rid of a suitor of his daughter, who he's locked up somewhere in the attic. Pretty, you know, gruesome stuff. And who, again, he doesn't want her to marry him, because then money and he'd lose her, and he doesn't want that. Well, the girl is Violet Hunter, goes to Sherlock Holmes, and, like, we talked about her on the women podcast as well.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, she's the one who just says, there's something wrong here. I need someone's opinion. There's something not quite right, because, like, she notices this man standing outside the gate, and the funny thing is that she thinks that he is kind of, well, the villain, and you're kind of set up to think, you know, something strange is going on, and it's because of this man, but it turns out, actually, the really evil people are Mr. and Mrs. Rucast locked up their daughter in the attic. And that's something that happens, obviously, quite often in the stories. I mean, we all watch crime television, and if a guy or a girl gets caught halfway through and gets accused of a crime, you kind of look at your watch and go, well, we've still got 30 minutes to go, so it's no way. And it's kind of a similar thing, but also, you know, locking your own daughter up in an attic and worrying her about stuff until she gets brain fever, whatever that is supposed to be. I mean, torturing your own child is just...
It's not a very nice thing to do.
No, it's not. Can we talk about how in the Granada series, Natasha Richardson plays Violet?
And how she's completely
really?
Awesome.
She doesn't, she's a very, it was like her first performance, wasn't it? But anyway, Natasha Richardson was in it. She was fantastic. I loved her.
Okay, so Moriarty is the main bad guy, or rather, it's the one that everyone capitalizes on in, like, all forms. Because he's, like, the arch nemesis, and it kind of, like, you go to, like, the superheroes, and they always have, like, the evil villain, so it's kind of, like, that balancing thing. And he's the one who kills Sherlock, kills quotation marks, yeah.
Causing everybody to go outside the Strand and be like, what have you done? Have you done?
Why? Ambervale, she talked about saying Moriarty is awesome, and said Fleming 77, and What Ho Centurion, amazing Twitter name, said, I'd love it if you talked about various film versions of Moriarty and how the character changes from adaptation to adaptation, which I thought was interesting because there obviously are quite a few versions of Moriarty.
There is one actor who has played both Sherlock Holmes and Moriarty, but I can't remember who it is.
Well, that is a useless fact now.
It is a useless fact, isn't it? I'm going to very subtly look it up while talking.
While we continue talking. Yes, all the versions of Moriarty. I know, like, which one to start with. I don't know. Should we just, I know, Andrew Scott, should we just start off with that one and then...
Work our way back.
Yeah, because he's very different from every other version that's kind of ever been, because he's described like this old man, he's an old professor. But I personally love the fact that they made Moriarty young and closer to Sherlock's age, because I think it suits the modern adaptation very well, because you sort of have like this cheeky young guy, and you have like all the creepy hackers and stuff these days that pretty much are like computer geniuses. So I think that kind of balanced it off very well, and he's just super creepy and doesn't blink in that last scene. If you watch, he never blinks. It is creepy.
Do you know what I love most about Andrew Scott's Moriarty, and I almost feel like you don't so much see it in the Granada adaptation or even in the books, is that he has a very thin line between his insanity and his sane face. And he jumps from it like instantaneously. Like just, that I know that they make fun of it on Tumblr with the whole, I will set fire to warm you up. It's just there's that moment where you're just like, holy crap, this guy's really, wait, that's just weird. Don't do that, dude.
I know. It's kind of, he's just being like cheeky and a bit of a jerk. And then it's like, that's what people do. And you're like,
right.
It catches you off guard.
Very much so, yeah.
I think also in that final scene, you see how easily Sherlock and him could have been each other. And I think that's something that I don't necessarily see in so many other versions of Moriarty. I have to be honest here and say most of the Sherlock 2010 Moriarty for me is kind of OTT Disney villain, but that dynamic that you really see how easily, because of the way the whole episode played out, the whole episode, John was like Sherlock's moral compass, or at least trying to be, and Sherlock was like, what the hell are you talking about? And then in that final scene, you kind of see what happens if someone goes amoral, who is that clever. And I don't think that I've seen that with that kind of clarity.
No, definitely for sure. Because he constantly says, like, we're made for each other. Because they're like two sides of one coin, and they could so easily be flipped. Like, if Sherlock didn't have John, if he got that bored, then I could see him being. He could use, like, all his skills for nefarious reasons.
Well, it's what Sally Donovan says in the very first episode. One day we'll stand around a body and Sherlock Holmes is going to be the one who put it there.
And he even says, like, in the books all the time, like, I would make a fantastic criminal.
That is true, yeah, when he's moaning about how the criminal classes, are dropping in standards and how there's nothing going on and everything.
And Watson's just like, what are you talking about?
I think he actually moans about the decline of the criminal classes on, like, a fortnightly basis, at least.
No one's gentlemanly enough to take him on. Alright, well, I found out that there are, in fact, two actors who have on film played both Holmes and Moriarty. First one is Anthony Higgins, who played...
Oh, what? He's from Young Sherlock Holmes.
Yes, Sherlock Holmes, he played the schoolmaster Rat, who then turns out to be Moriarty. And then in the 1993 film Sherlock Holmes Returns, he actually plays Holmes. Now, there's also a film, The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, for comic book fans.
fans, don't watch it, it's awful.
Yep.
If you like it, don't watch it.
Yep. Richard Roxburgh portrays a villain called the Phantom, who is later revealed to be Professor Moriarty. That's Phantom spelled with an F, just so you know. Very nice. And then in the 2002 adaptation of The Hound of the Baskervilles, he played Holmes. So both of those actors have managed to play both the hero and the villain. A bit weird for them, but...
That's be fun playing the bad guy, though.
But is there really that much of a difference? I mean, I think Artie kind of touched base on it. I mean, they're two sides of the coin.
I said that.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'll give credit where credit's due. Curly said that. But that the only difference is that Sherlock does his work for good, Moriarty does his work for evil or bad.
Yeah, I think I like that about them, because they are just basically the same person that made like a different life choice.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what was really interesting is I remember going to a talk by Mark Gatiss. And he said, when Sherlock was younger, there must have been some kind of decision where he was like, good or evil? which I thought was really interesting. And what he said was, he thought that Holmes chose good, not because of any moral obligation, but because it was harder, which I thought was really interesting.
Oh.
I would agree with that, because it's very easy to be evil.
Yeah, so, you know, maybe he chose to be good because it offered him more of a challenge. That says a lot about perhaps what his morals are like. But then, of course, he does seem to have a lot of morals because he'll help, you know, people who are very poor, who have very, you know, complicated crimes and won't charge them any money. And obviously he has this kind of almost, like, detest of Charles Augustus Milverton. So I think he does, I think he pretends not to have morals, but he probably does have quite a strong,
yes,
you know, moral. He just, like, likes to complain about it.
Yeah, we even see that, like, throughout the course of the Great Game. Like, at one point he's like, will caring about them help save them? And then when he's confronting Moriarty, he's like, people have died. And that's like, that's what people do. So, yeah. Can you see, like, that?
How you said it, like, that's
what people do.
I think he is kind of like, he almost kind of pushes the background, but I think he does care. But I think there is an element of, like, being good is more of a challenge for his intellect.
I would agree with that.
I think I'm going to have to go, guys.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Continue on without me. Go on without me.
That's so true.
Don't leave a man behind.
Just leave me behind, that's fine.
Alright, enjoy your kanji.
Have fun.
Right, bye guys.
Bye.
Bye.
I would like to bring up the fact that in the Russian Sherlock Holmes, which I haven't watched but I've only seen clips of, the Moriarty in that one looks so scary. It looks like a corpse with, like, his hair.
Yeah, I've watched that. I think the final fight at Reichenbach Falls is really creepy, because in the Granada version, I mean, I love the Granada version, but they didn't waste a lot of money on stunt training or on fights. The fight scenes in it are always kind of camp and ridiculous, and the final fight at Reichenbach Falls is no exception, which is both good and bad. Good because it really takes the edge off, because it is just so sad to see Watson left behind. And in the Russian version, he actually cries, like there's a single teardrop that falls on this note that Holmes left. But the final fight is actually quite creepy, because you get the feeling that, you know, it could go either way, and there's so often that they get so close to that cliff and you're kind of like on the edge of your seat, even though you know what's gonna happen. But I agree, the actor who plays him is just, he's proper scary.
Super creepy. He reminds me of the mannequin in the Sherlock Holmes Museum.
Oh god.
I will never get over that mannequin.
Yeah, that was, the leering was enough to creep me out.
I've never actually, I haven't seen the Russian version, so I don't know how the actor actually portrays him. What would you say, Artie?
I'd say he got a lot from the text in terms of body movement. There's somewhere in the canon, which Andrew Scott also used, which mentions that he had something reptilian about him.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Kind of rolling gaze that would veer from one end of the room to the other. Andrew Scott does that in the final scene of The Great Game.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's reptilian head movement. I mean, that actor does that as well, but at the same time, like, he moves his head and nothing else. He's just sitting there in his chair, and he's just menacing. So, yeah.
You know, I'm actually anxious to see if the Guy Ritchie version of Sherlock Holmes, the second one that's coming out,
mm-hmm.
is going to show Moriarty this time. Because you see Moriarty, but you don't really see Moriarty in the first one.
No, yeah, a lot of the promo pics have him.
It, oh,
yeah.
Okay.
It's just the ginger guy, yeah?
Yeah, well, he's been...
Ginger Moriarty! Yeah. I assume that's who it is. I forget the actor's name.
Yeah.
But he has a top hat, so I think they're going the more gentlemanly route.
Well, that'll be good.
Yeah. I mean, he's younger. He's not an old, decrepit professor. He's a professor, but he's not old. He's young.
Any comments on other versions of Moriarty? Which ones have you guys seen?
I haven't seen the Granada version yet.
So I've seen that one.
If you guys want to go on that one, because I want to talk about Radigan.
No, I think Artie said it all. When it really came to the Granada version, it's subtle. I don't feel like it wasn't over the top. The whole Reichenbach thing, he was good. I feel like I'm giving a review. This isn't, I think there were, it was, yeah, I don't know. Sorry. I'm gonna shut up now.
Okay, question for you then, to maybe kickstart you. You know that conversation, everything I could say has already crossed your mind. Contrast that on Sherlock, that's how it happens on Renata.
Oh, crap. No, I don't. I haven't watched it in so long.
You wanna answer your own question?
I don't. No, well, I remember that because I'm just talking all the time, and you know, it's...
Talk, because I'm about to go on my great mouse detective spiel, so you go.
The thing with Granada is, I think we talked about this on the first podcast, that the actors who played it were quite old. Like, Jeremy Brett was 56 when they started filming it, and that's the age when Pond's canonically retired. So on the modern show, we have a younger Moriarty because we have a younger Holmes and a younger Watson. It fits very well. But on the Granada show, you have this relationship between Sherlock Holmes and Professor Moriarty, and Sherlock Holmes actually goes to literally Beard the Lion in his den. That's lifted from the canon. He goes to see Professor Moriarty in his house, and then he comes back and tells the whole story to Watson. Watson is like completely aghast, going, "What are you doing? Going to this guy's house? Are you out of your mind? Why would you do that?" But they have this wonderful conversation where Moriarty basically says, "Well, you know how this is going to end. You are in the way of my plans. These are the dates on which you have inconvenienced me, and you can either stop what it is that you're doing or I will end you." Basically, he's saying the only way that this can end is with either of us dead, and because I am so effing good at what I do, you know, and they have in the Granada adaptation, it's really these two Victorian gentlemen who have this face off, and you can just cut the tension with a knife during that whole scene, and it's all in the looks and the poses, and they're sitting at a table like civilized people having this conversation that basically says, you know, at the end of this, one of us is going to die at the hands of the other. Well, Sherlock Holmes, well, eventually makes the statement saying, "I guess my answer has forced yours. Neither of us has anything more to say about this. I'm just going to pick up my hat and coat and I'm going to leave. I'm not going to stop what I'm doing just because you think you can intimidate me." And the way that Eric Roberts and Joan Brett played that on the Granada show gets me every time. It's like Moriarty is the only person who can call Sherlock Holmes on the stuff that he does. Like, he went into Moriarty's house with a gun in his pocket, and Moriarty calls him on it. He says, "If I were you, I would not finger loaded firearms in my pocket. You know, that can be very, very dangerous," basically. And he's the only person in the whole canon who ever does that. You know, and that's kind of something that they adapted in the modern show as well, because, you know, Sherlock has this gun and he scratches his temple with a loaded gun and everything because he gets so nervous. He gets nervous around Moriarty. He never gets nervous around anything.
I think that's what makes Moriarty so scary, though, because he makes Sherlock so nervous, and that he knows exactly what Sherlock's thinking, and you think, well, crap, what's he going to do now in order to outsmart him?
Yeah, he knows how to play off of him, and no one has really been able to do that before, not to that level.
Right.
While you were, like, explaining that all already, the only thing I could think about was, like, cake or death, or, like, like, here's a piece, I'm going to kill you, would you like some tea?
Sorry, we're out of cake.
So my choice is or death.
I'll have the chicken then. Thank you, Eddie.
Do you know, there's one kind of villain that we haven't touched base on yet that I actually really, really like.
Mm-hmm.
And it's Stapleton from The Hound of the Baskervilles.
Oh, Amberville, she actually mentioned that. Sorry. She said, "I have a weak spot for Stapleton."
Yeah. I wouldn't go as far as saying I have a weak spot. He's clever. He's a clever guy, though, and very smart and very educated, but he...
Extremely dark, though.
Yes, very, very, very dark. I mean, first of all, let's talk about the fact that, you know, he takes his wife and kind of pimps her out to the new, you know, Baskerville when he arrives. Oh, yeah, here's my sister. Enjoy her. and then...
Yeah.
But, you know, and then gets, you know, very protective of that whole, okay, I can't leave those two together anymore because something's clearly happening and my wife slash sister is going to, you know, expose me for what I'm trying to do here. And the whole thing with the, I mean, can I, there's a lot of plot things. Is it okay for me to?
Yes. This.
Oh,
yeah. Really old.
Okay.
Spoilers!
Okay.
Spoilers!
Spoilers! I mean, the whole thing with the dog and the phosphorus and, you know, using a story from the Moors and bringing it to life in a way by, you know, caging this dog up that's massive, covering it in phosphorus to make it glow so it looks ghostly, and then setting it on people. Who comes up with that?
A very bored man.
But, I mean, just every... it's like he almost had every little detail down, but the fact that he lost control, and that's the big reason why it didn't work for him, and why he wasn't able to get what he was aiming for, which was his birthright, so to speak.
And then the fact that, like, speaking of locking ladies up in the attic.
Yeah.
And like physical abuse, like that's like so apparent in that story, and it just makes like the whole, because like it's like a gothic horror and stuff, but it's just a very dark story when you look at it, sort of at the little different aspects of it. Like he has physically abused his wife's sister and locked her up and tied her up, like physically restraining her in the attic so she couldn't warn anybody about what he was about to do.
Yeah. So yeah, Stapleton's evil.
Evil. Mwah.
But anyway, yeah, I think he's one of my favorite villains, because he's so clever. The thing with the glowing dog is what gets me the entire time.
I'm that going to cover a puppy in phosphorus.
And make it look like a ghost, except it'll eat you alive.
Because I starve it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So we've got spousal abuse, animal abuse, among other things that are going on in this story. Yeah, he's definitely one of those, I think, big villains in the Sherlock Holmes world.
Okay, so I'm going to go back to the Moriarty adaptations because I really like this one movie. I don't know if you know about it. But legitimately, Radigan, as like a Moriarty sort of character, is shut up! He's terrified. Like, as a kid, like, I was like, the Big Ben scene is legitimately terrifying. Like, it's the Great Mouse Detective version of Reichenbach.
Yeah.
And like, when he's like, busy, it's so creepy. He's like all hairy and shit, and he's like chasing after him. And then like, the actual like fight that they have, which is quite, I would say, big for Disney at the time. Because, like, the older Disney movies, I guess, did have a bit of a dark quality to them, and then they kind of sidestepped that and sprinkled it with sugar as they got further and further into the 90s. But I think that Radigan as, like, the Moriarty thing, like, there's some similarities, and I think there are some, like, lines from the canon in some form that he says. I can't remember at the moment. But I don't know. I like him as a villain. He is definitely my favorite Disney villain of all time.
Well, I don't know about canon references because it's been a while since I watched it, but like the whole Rube Goldberg machine that he's got them in the end is definitely a reference to the Baz Luhrmann movies because they run into machines like that in several of them.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
We didn't really talk about Moran at all. Moriarty's little henchy. And I can only imagine him as Fidget right now. The little bat.
It'll be interesting to see if the BBC version of Sherlock actually has a Moran.
I really hope they do.
Yeah, they gave us a nice little red herring in naming banker Sebastian, but he has a different surname.
Right. And I know a lot of people who've watched Sherlock have picked up on that and kind of think that that's going to be the case. I don't know, it'll be interesting to see.
That'd be interesting.
Yeah, I mean, because clearly if they do the Reichenbach fall, you hope that the empty house will follow.
Yes, please.
And if that's the case, then you do need to have a sort of henchman, and whether or not that's, you know, going to be Sebastian Morin or, you know, somebody else. But I think he's a very interesting, you know, evil character because he's a decorated war hero who, you know, the government has, you know, he served his Majesty's government, you know, and went to in, was it India?
Yeah, somewhere like that.
Yeah, and, you know, and but not only was he known as, like, a decorated war hero, he was also the guy who went out and slayed tigers.
Like you do.
So, yeah, you know, I'm here, what the hell, let's take a big cat down while we're out here. I think that's part of the genius, and goes to the whole idea of, you know, choosing which direction you're going to go into. Here's a guy who was clearly doing good up to a point, and then all of a sudden he gets hired by Moriarty and starts working with him.
And becomes very loyal very quickly.
Yeah, and in essence tries to revenge his employer's death, mm-hmm. in a way. So,
he's like the naughty John, pretty much.
I was going to say, he's Watson's opposite number, just as Moriarty is Holmes's mm-hmm. opposite number.
Right.
Very loyal, decorated war hero.
Although I can't picture John Watson shooting down a big tiger.
Depends on which adaptation.
No, Martin Freeman, he'd just be like petting a kitten.
Yeah.
He's made of kittens, we all know that.
But I could see Edward Hardwick maybe shooting a tiger. I could definitely see Jude Law.
Yeah, really, yeah.
Beating him
yeah,
with a cane.
Oh, yeah.
On a scale of 1 to 10, how likely is this Watson to shoot a tiger?
Yeah, SH, what's your long we had this Watson scale from Dormat to Banff? But I digress.
What was that? Not all villains are enemies? Adversaries. That's the word she
worked.
Yeah.
Hold on, I'm getting on the Twitter.
I'm going there right now. I'm 2 steps ahead of you. Ah, but in Sherlock Holmes, adversaries are not always villains. And I agree with that. The first person that comes to mind is Irene Adler. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, she wasn't a villain, in my opinion. She just happened to have a photograph that with the King of Bohemia who wanted it back.
Yes. And she's like, no.
Right. So I would definitely put her under the adversary category.
Well, you have quite often, you have this sort of plot twist where it turns out that the villain, someone who committed the dastardly crime in question, is actually a victim. For instance, you have in the Abbey Grange, you know, Sir Eustace gets killed, and it mm-hmm. turns out that, in actual fact, the person who killed him wasn't necessarily an evil person, because Sir Eustace, you know, abused his wife and was a drinker, and the right. person who killed him was the person who actually loved her. So if there is a villainous person in that story, it's actually Sir Eustace and not the guy who killed him. And there's a similar thing in The Cardboard Box, possibly the darkest and saddest and most depressing story in the canon. The person who kills a woman and her newly wedded husband, and then sends their ears in a cardboard box to her sister.
It's just rude.
Yeah. It's, you know, that is, I mean, for a Sherlock Holmes story, that's pretty gruesome.
It is.
Sherlock Holmes eventually finds him, and hears the whole story from him, and it's this woman he used to be married to, basically, you know, cast him off, divorced him, whatever, because her sister was in love with him, and she kind of planted, you know, evil ideas in her sister's head so that she'd get rid of him and get this new husband. And he went away and started drinking, and then he saw her with a newly wedded husband and just, you know, went into rage mode and killed them. And if he'd seen this sister, who was the scheming mind behind all this, he'd probably have killed her. And I wouldn't say there's that he was necessarily evil, but that is really like kind of psychologically twisted, and you just feel sorry for everyone in that story by the end of it.
Yeah. What's the name of the bad guy in The Dying Detective? Yeah, because I really like the Granada adaptation of that, mostly because the bad guy is the dad from Jumanji. And I'm like, like, you play a bad guy in every movie you are ever in.
Kind of like Mark Strong, right?
Yeah. It's like, you just got one of those faces.
Yeah, Mr. Culverton Smith.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Holla. Yes,
that,
him.
That was the one you were thinking of?
Yes. He's a bit of a jerk, but, like, kills his cousin. It's his cousin, right? I don't know. Well, kills this dude.
Yeah.
Hugh Bonneville. He kills Hugh Bonneville.
Damn it!
So sorry, spoilers! And then he's trying to inherit this house, which is rightfully, you know, to the wife and children. And it's through, like, the logic in this particular story, it's like, you figure it out, like, immediately. It's like, he's this expert in this one deadly tropical disease, and it just so happens that Hugh Bonneville happens to get this horrible tropical disease and dies. And then Sherlock Holmes gets this horrible tropical disease and he's dying, and then the guy shows up, he's like, "Bah-ha-ha, it was me!" And it's like, "Yeah, I know." And Watson comes out of the corner, he's like, "Hey, I heard it all!" And it was all a ruse, and it was fantastic. That's my awesome summary of the dying detective.
Curly's clip notes to the dying detective.
Hugh Bonneville. They're playing this weird game in the Granada version. And they're, like, sliding along the floor, and then, you know, he slips, and it's all very bad.
I'm actually going to have to watch this version now, because every time I think of Hugh Bonneville, all I see him is in his short shorts. In Third Star, because that scene is hilarious.
Brilliant.
Hilarious. Anyway, back to topic.
Hang on, Sherlock Holmes.
Jen, you wanted to talk about how not all villains, not all adversaries are villains.
Flipping through the list of stories, I would even go as far as saying that, and this you know falls into the whole you know moral ambiguity that are always in these stories anyway with Sherlock Holmes, but I would say even in A Study in Scarlet, the very very first story was very you know this guy was going around killing all the people who ruined his life. I don't necessarily think vengeance necessarily makes you a villain per se. You're a villain to the people you kill, but you know, it falls into that whole moral ambiguity. I mean, he was anyway.
Like these people hurt him. It's like revenge. It's very tricky gray area. I think revenge always is,
right?
Because like, do they deserve it because they did it first, or do they not because you know revenge is bad?
Right.
Yeah. Someone on Twitter actually asked about Jefferson Hope, which is the person that we're right now.
Oh, I didn't get that one. Sorry.
And said, they'd like a comparison. Because Jefferson Hope obviously is what the evil cabbie in Study and Think is based on.
Mm-hmm. I know, it's hard. Because, like, he's doing a very, very naughty thing in poisoning people. It's just not a nice thing to do. But you still feel for him as a character, which is, I think the best villains maybe are the ones that you feel a little bit sorry for.
You mean in the short story?
Yes.
And you could totally leave this in the podcast. Are we referring to A Study in Scarlet or A Study in Pink?
I think Christina was talking about Study in Scarlet just
now. Okay, all yeah. Right. And you're wanting to talk about how that relates to the cabbie in Study in Pink.
Yeah, because someone on Twitter asked. I'm going to go on Twitter and see who it was so I can do it.
My bad!
No, that's okay. I was just sitting here going, wait, is she talking about the cabbie who is poisoning people in the present or the people in the past? Because it's like this fictional world of trying to keep things straight.
So many cabbies, so much poison.
So little time.
So little time. But did anyone else think about the scene in The Princess Bride with the two bottles?
Everyone.
It's like, they're both poison, come on!
It became a fandom trope. Oh god, someone with a lot of X's in their Twitter username, so I'm just going to call you Kaylee, because there's three X's and then Kaylee, and there's lots more X's. So,
X and Kaylee.
Kaylee asked for Jefferson Hope.
You've thoroughly confused us all.
No, I actually agree with you, Christina. It's that moral ambiguity. You know, he went through all this hardship, you know, in Utah, trying to protect this girl, and he vowed vengeance. And I think a lot of people can relate to that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that's, I think that's what makes it so, so interesting in a study in Scarlet. You know, here's a guy that, I mean, even, you know, Holmes even says it himself. He's like, look, guy's dying. He's going to be dead because of his, you know, I can't remember if it's an aneurysm in A Study in Scarlet.
It is an aneurysm of the heart, though, not brain.
Oh, right, yeah. So, you know, he's just like, look, he's going to drop dead soon anyway. You know, a lot of people understand that. That this guy's, he's a dead man walking, which is what the cabbie in The Study in Pink calls himself. He goes, I'm a dead man walking. But I think the big difference, though, is in A Study in Pink, he was paid by Moriarty to go around doing this, and the cabbie actually calls it fun.
Yeah, and it was just random people. It wasn't, like, with a purpose.
Right. That he, you know, he was bored. And then he's like, I've outlived people. Oh, okay. That's not creepy at all whatsoever.
It's like, oh, that's nice.
Yeah, I've won at my little game, and I'm you know, I've lived longer than these people that I've killed. That makes me, you know, that makes me feel good. Okay, keep telling yourself that.
Yeah.
So I think that's a really, you know, a really good way of, you know, differentiating the two. I almost feel like Jefferson Hope in A Study in Scarlet had a reason, whereas, well, no, you know what, I take that back. The cabbie had a reason too, didn't he? I mean, he was getting paid for his kids. Yeah.
Damn.
I don't know. I feel like the cabbie was a bit more vicious about it than Jefferson Hope was. You're right. The cabbie was picking people at random, whereas Jefferson Hope had, you know, blinders on and was looking for specific people.
Yeah. And one of the people that the cabbie killed in Study in Pink was actually an 18-year-old boy.
Yeah.
Which kind of defeats the whole, you know, I'm doing this for my kids thing. Because if you're killing other kids so that your kids get, you know, a bit more money when you die.
I don't know, is that villains wrapped up? Are there any other big ones that we're forgetting?
I'm sure there are. There's so many.
We are on top form this evening.
I think we've hit all the well-known villains of the Sherlock Holmes world.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say something that is not connected to villains at all, but that is in reference to a question that we got on Twitter from Sagacity19, who asked about the bullpup that Watson kept. We originally answered that it was a real dog called Gladstone, and then Sagacity asked, was Gladstone mentioned in the canon? And actually, Gladstone is not mentioned by name, but a lot of people think that it was a reference to an actual dog. There are some other people that think that it was reference to Watson's, well, nowadays we'd call it PTSD, like any kind of after effects that he had from the war, you know, that is a reference to that. But I agree with whoever made the decision for the Richie Sherlock Holmes film to say that it was an actual dog, even though he's never mentioned again in the canon. But then that's Arthur Continuity Doyle for you. So yeah, that's just what I have to say to Sagacity. I hope that answers the question.
Yeah. that was my bad for jumping the gun on that one.
Yeah,
I know there's a dog, eh?
Yeah, no, I didn't actually know, but, like, if I have these awesome, you know, annotated editions by Leslie S. Klinger, and they have all these random, wonderful annotations about anything and everything, and the bullpup one is one of them, and I just happened to read it when I was rereading Certain Scarlet. Anywho!
Alright, well, that's all for episode 7. Yes, it's 7. Yay! I don't know, the next one may be the super special one, or that may... I can't say anything about. Or we may have another one before that, I'm not sure. It'll either be the Paget one, Paget, however the hell you say his name.
Paget.
Paget. Paget, I was completely wrong. And,
well, that's how I say it.
Okay. I already may be completely wrong. The drawing guy. Or the
illustrator.
The illustrator. So we'll see. I don't know. It's a mystery. Nah. As per usual. I'm going to say goodbye. Say goodbye to the camera. Not the camera, the microphone.
It's good that we don't have cameras.
Well. Yeah, I was just going to say that. It's a really good thing we don't have that.
We'll have to tidy up my room.
Oh, and also, I wrote this on the Tumblr, but Geek Girls Network will be interviewing Big Tree Babes as a whole, but I guess I'll be the one representing us, and that will be in October, so look out for that. I'll try not to embarrass us. too
please,
much.
Please, please.
I will. I'll try my hardest. I'll be a good girl, Sherlocky girl, whatever. I can't talk anymore. Like, I need to, like, go get some tea or something.
And what's Curly's done for the evening.
One o'clock in the morning, I'm starting to feel really hyper.
Oh dear! And you've been drinking water.
I've been drinking water, yeah.
Lots of water. Maybe I'll go get a bottle of water upstairs. Not that I need it. But so on that note, this has been the villain episode of the Big Shoe Babes podcast. Watch your back.
Dun dun dun.
Did you know that we have a store? We do. It has awesome things in it. You can get a mug that has our logo on it. Yeah, I know. Try to contain yourself. We also have a 221B1, which I have and I use all the time, and it makes me really freaking happy. We also have a Tell Us About Rupert Graves. Yeah, we have that on a mug and a button and a tote bag. Oh my god, guys, we got tote bags, but most importantly, and you need to take this seriously, we have shot glasses. I know. But you can use water. You know, you can take shots of water. It's very important to drink water every day. But yeah, you can go to our website and click on shop and look at our cafe press store. All of the proceeds from it go to our bandwidth because it is really freaking expensive. Thank you so much to everyone who has already bought things and who have sent us pictures and stuff. It's really cool to see people with like their Big Sheep Babes mugs and tote bags and all sorts of stuff. So get a button, walk around with it, it'll be awesome. And we'll be like, oh my god, where did you get that button? Oh my god, where did you get that keychain? And you'll be like, you know what? The Big Sheep Babes. That's right. So be cool and buy something from the Big Sheep Babes shop. Watcha!
If this quotidian world has got you crying, won't you 2-2-1 be mine?
Strange murderous fate, I admit I've some regrets.
been fun.